Hello everyone and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Today is part two of my interview with Paul Shirley, Paul Shirley of the NBA, Europe and Writer's Block. Today we talk about Chris Anstey, Ben Gordon's essay on basketball and mental health, working with Bill Simmons of The Ringer, and whether Paul is the hero or villain of his own book, Can I Keep My Jersey? For context, I strongly recommend you listen to part one. In the show notes, you will find links to how to sign up to the NBL Pocket Podcast Patreon, how to buy a copy of Paul Shirley's Can I Keep My Jersey, and also a link to Booktopia if you're looking to buy any other book or DVD. But more important than buying any books or signing up to the NBL Pocket Podcast Patreon, the most important thing is sitting back and enjoying this part two of my interview with Paul Shirley. And here he is. You got two great pieces of advice in your book. And these have really stuck with me forever when I first read it over a decade ago. If I wasn't around for the coining of the nickname, I'm not allowed to use it. Great rule to life. And number two, this is from page 259. I think you summed it up here. I've actually left my copy of the book, but it's when you're talking about, and I wish I had the exact quote, but you come out of the hotel in, I think it's Russia, and you're just kind of like, you've met that girl and you're like, what am I doing here? You're just standing there like, oh, this is kind of what life is, where you just find yourself in a situation where you shouldn't be there. You've got yourself there, but you go with it anyway. I wish I had my copy.
I'm flattered that you have it.
As I stood on a darkened plaza in Nymburk, waiting for a girl to appear and for us to do God knows what before the team left in an hour and a quarter, I considered the absurdity of the situation. That's it. That's what I took. I just thought the idea of just finding yourself in places, and I just really liked it.
I think I was with Chris Anstey in that night in Nymburk.
He goes, yeah. His advice, he was like, go get it or something like that. I wish I had it.
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, buddy. I mean, I think that's been one of the real upsides of the career that I had was that it forced a kid from a really small place in Kansas to learn how to adapt to strange situations. I think what served me well was a continued, I don't know, confusion and or naivete about those situations that I found myself in. And I think, like, I would guess that that's what has worked out in some of my writing, is that I always thought, like, I will get to play professional basketball someday. Yeah. But I never necessarily expected that it would look like it did. I think that has continued to be true. I don't know that I ever expected to live in Los Angeles and write books and do the things that I do now. But here we are, and I think it is really so vital that we're all able to keep some attitude of wonder about the circumstances we find ourselves in, because then that means that life continues to bloom and unfold in ways that are surprising and make it worth living.
And that line is why I like it, because I think if you strive for those moments above successive stuff, if you strive for that moment of standing on a thing, kind of semi-relying on people, putting your faith in people, but not too much, obviously, that is a pretty good place to be at. And the more you do it, I think it's really rewarding. You gushed over European basketball. You wrote, I wish more people from the United States could see good European basketball. It reminds a person of the beautiful thing the game can be. Do you still hold that opinion of European basketball?
I do, I think. I haven't watched a lot of European basketball in recent years, but I do think that in the same way I talked about how the salary structure is a little more democratic, I suppose, there's a sense that it's less about the individual player and more about the team. I think, you know, that can come off a little stay off my lawn, but there's nothing wrong with individual sports, right? Like, go play tennis if you're interested in playing an individual sport, and more power to you. But if you're playing basketball, it exists inherently as a team sport, and so does football, and so does Australian rules football, and so does baseball. So I think, like, one thing that we do poorly in the US is we tend to make everything about, like, who's the CEO, who's the star player. Like it becomes about the individual instead of realizing that like it's a unit. And I think in Europe, I was able to find a lot of spots where there was this, I mean, there are always going to be egos, but there was a lot more emphasis on, we're just in this together and we're going to go try to beat that team tonight.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you feel like Australia does that same?
Yeah, I do. Certainly. I mean, I think also I'm still deciding myself whether it's a matter of that the NBA, let's talk about specifically, whether the NBA does that consciously, whether coaches are like, all right, give it to our best player and get out of the way, or if that's just how the game is then digested and consumed and understood. I think it's really easy to understand basketball through that prism of there's our best player, get him the ball, he's the leader, they're the followers. Very easy, fits into a story framework that people can really understand. So I'm still deciding whether that's actually what's going on or if that's the impression of it. And I think in Australia, I think because the league isn't as followed very closely, it's not hugely popular. I think it's reverting to that natural conversation of basketball, which is, yeah, more team oriented. So, so that. But I'm still kind of looking at the NBA thinking, is this just all just working through a storyline? I mean, Americans are great storytellers. It's Mark Twain. No one puts out their story quite like the United States as well or as readily. You know, everything is told. And you know, we get in Australia, we get political shows about the USA and people here, they consume it and buy it, but it's so foreign, it's so far away. I'm amazed that people have an interest, but that's a bit of a borrowed answer. Your book reminds me of Steve Martin's wonderful biography, Born Standing Up. Have you read that book? Was it an inspiration, if so?
I have audiobooked that book, which I think is a different way of consuming. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that he's great. I am flattered that you think that about my book. I think I saw a great Steve Martin like post the other day where he was like, something's been bothering me about this pandemic. And then he put on a piece of paper over his head that said, I'm Steve Martin. And you could still recognize that he was Steve Martin even behind the mask. Right. And I was like, that's so great. Cause he's like admitting of his own egotism. Right. Which is genius. And I think I relate to that because I am self-effacing, but I also kind of think highly of myself, or I wouldn't have been able to do some of the things that I've been able to do. And I think that that also rubs people the wrong way sometimes, because I think they want you one way or the other. They want you to be Michael Jordan and a sociopath, or they want you to be, aw shucks, and I didn't really deserve it. And I think in some ways, I actually aw shucksed myself to death early in my career and even in some of my writings, that sort of has worked against me a little bit. In the Midwest, and I think Australia is a little bit like this, we tend to distrust people who talk about themselves. Like,
it tends to be
the truth that we would assume if you are self-deprecating that you have a lot of confidence and vice versa. Now, in some ways, American culture has started to veer towards like you really got to stick up for like, I'm good and I'm the best. I tend to think like by being self-deprecating, that is confident. But I think that gets lost sometimes in a social media world where people can just think like, well, he just doesn't respect himself. And you're like, no, I do. That's the whole point of being self-deprecating.
Speaking about another book, David Foster Wallace. I mean, we've touched on it without saying it. We've been talking about postmodernism and irony in his book, Infinite Jest. Do you think your book and style is postmodern? Does your book have heart? Have you heard? I don't know if you've read that book or his sort of theory about sort of like, do you come away with a moral of the story from Can I Keep My Jersey?
I think like one person has ever gotten what I was trying to accomplish with that book, which was that I was trying to imply how hopeful I was at the beginning of it and how jaded I had gotten by the end. Because it was kind of a grinder. You know, you go into sports, I think, with this like sort of happy-go-lucky, like, I'm just the kid, the 12-year-old who showed up and wants to shoot some hoops, right? And then it becomes so monstrous at times because there's so much money and there are so many egos attached, and you forget like why you started doing it. And I think by the end of that first book, I was pretty tired. I was just ready to be done. And I don't know that I doubt that I did as good a job expressing that. I think back then, and I still fight with this, like, I think when you're young as a writer, you tend to try to obscure things, hoping that the audience will get there. And a lot of times you just got to come out and say like, hello, I'm jaded now. And then they'll get it. I don't know if, I think like the way that we consume literature just changes, right? So like by the time I was writing my book, it was in vogue to have asides and digressions and all of this stuff.
Bill Simmons did that. He had footnotes and things. Yeah.
And so like, you know, if you read Consider the Lobster, which is David Foster Wallace's collection of essays, there's like these notes of go down here and read the rest of this. And I think I really enjoyed that at the time. And so it was maybe more just like, that was the style that I was reading a lot of. I don't know. I mean, I think I would be remiss if I began trying to classify exactly what style my nonfiction writing is. I think now what I rely on is like, just try to tell a story that keeps people's attention. I'm working on fiction. I'm working on fiction now. And a lot of times I'll get way into the weeds because I'm like, Jesus Christ, how do you write a novel? But one thing to fall back on is like, if I were telling this story in a bar, could I keep people's attention? And I think that's, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, just like stay with that. Cause you can always sense, again, if you have any like ability to pay attention to people's feelings, like, am I losing them? Are they? That's one of the hard parts about podcasting, actually, right? Like, you don't have a live audience to signal to you, like, Jesus, wrap it up. Whereas if you're, you know, if I'm giving a talk somewhere, I can sort of see, like, you know what? They can handle a little digression here because, like, they're in. Or, like, we got to get to the meat of this because I'm going to lose them if not.
One thing I wanted to go on about Can I Keep My Jersey? You sort of comment on race in it, and it's a different time then to now. Do you read the book and go, oh, you know, I like the way I did something? Because it's an interesting thing. You mean basketball, you go into it, and, you know, it's in the NBA anyway, it's predominantly African-American sport. And you talk about that quite openly. You're like, you know, I'm one of the pale faces and things like that. Was there ever any fear of writing that stuff, or, you know, how did you navigate that sort of environment?
I didn't really think about it too much at the time. I'm sure that if I wrote that book now, it would have to be, or it would be suggested to me that it would need to be different. I think one of the things that happens when you're in basketball is you become much more comfortable talking about race because it's just in your face all the time. So like there were situations where I would play in this summer league in Kansas City when I was in college, and if my mother didn't come with me, then I would be the only white person in the gym. And so like, you just sort of got comfortable laughing about it and not really, I mean, you notice, of course you notice it, but it's more in terms of like, well, this is weird, but it's also just how things are. And so you're also so immersed in black culture that it doesn't seem difficult to understand it or to even comment on it, even though I think now people would just jump all over you if you deigned to think that you could like talk about that. But it would be, you know, it's if you were black and you went to Harvard in 1930, you probably would have had a good idea of what white culture is like, because you're like, God, I'm just surrounded by that. I have a pretty good sense of like, I mean, in the same way that even when I went to Spain, I am an American in Spain and I lived there for 2 years, I felt like I had a pretty good handle on like my impression of Spanish culture. That doesn't mean I understand Spanish culture in its totality, but like I could tell you I have some pretty good thoughts on that because I was an observer. Like being an observer actually helps you in a lot of ways. Like I could digest Spanish culture better than I can digest American culture because I'm American. Like it's really hard to observe something when you're in the midst of it.
Yeah. Paul, when I say the name Austin Crozier, you say what?
Pain.
Yeah. Let's leave it at that. People can read the chapter. You describe watching an NBA game as strikingly boring. Just like any NBA game I have witnessed from the standpoint of a non-participant, I cannot believe that people are willing to pay and pay handsomely to watch such insanity. Has your opinion of the NBA changed? If so, why not?
When did I write that? That, I mean, it sounds like me. I can't watch the NBA. Like, it's just, I think it's just that it's like getting a divorce where there's nothing to be squeezed out of the relationship. It wasn't like, we're going to get divorced and see how it goes and maybe we'll get back together. It's just like, you know what? We're two people who've had enough and we're going to go our separate ways and we can be friends, but there's no chance of us backsliding. I think that's kind of how I feel about basketball. It's just, I squeezed every last bit out of myself, which is actually an amazing blessing, right? Like, yeah. There are not a lot of people who can say that. A lot of people, I think, and I saw a lot of these people, they would be like special assistants that are just trying to hang on to a team. And you're like, this is kind of pathetic because you don't really want to be a coach. You're just like, go do something else. Anyway, I think lucky because like I had enough injuries by the end that I was like, there was no part of me that was like, you know, I should push it for another 3 years. My body was just saying, you should stop immediately.
Really? It's funny because you talked about it in the podcast. When you went to training camp, I think it was Dennis Scott. You talk about it a little bit in your book. He also went to that training camp. And apparently this is where he got tapped on the shoulder and just said, like, listen, this is not for you. You're done. And don't even think about this. And he went and did something else. It's interesting that it was going one way and the other, but you both ended at the same place. Page 211, you describe running into a teammate in the shower. You want to ask about his massive penis. You redact the name. Why?
Yeah, I should have just like given him that boost. Yeah. For future lovers.
I don't think he would have complained.
I mean, I saw a lot of big dicks, so I don't even know whose it was.
All right. Okay.
Definitely seen more genitals than a port side whore.
I think I have a similar story where I was playing and there's an Algerian guy. He was, yeah, fair play to him. And, I remember it was when I quit. It was my last game. I just said, you know what? I really was like, what's the point? Just forget it. Because he dunked on me just before. So I was like, only one man can only have so much.
Did you walk out? Like, were you done after that game?
I was getting towards the end of it where I was like, I'm not enjoying this. But, you know, still I enjoy certain aspects of it. It was in Ireland at the time and the team was sponsored by a pub. So I was like, I don't want to forego that. But I was looking at the guy and he just, he dunked me. He was, and the worst part is he was super friendly. I would have preferred him. He was mean to me, but he was super friendly about it. So I was like, friendly, good looking, well hung. I was like, nah, this is his space. I'm happy to give it to him. So I report on sports. I'm always mindful of two things when I'm dealing with players or teams or coaches, whatever it is. Don't be a sniff, whatever, a sniff brother, I think it's described in The Last Dance, like a suck up to players. I don't think they want to listen to that nor appreciate it. And then the other thing is I always keep in mind that sports are pretty stupid. You know, I like Ernest Hemingway books. He's my favorite writer. You know, when he talks about manly pursuits, you know, and when you describe that fight, when the two players are fighting over a chair, you can't help but, you know, this is a really strange procure. How do you suppose I report on sports and give it genuine meaning? Like your book, Stories I Tell on Dates. How do you give sport something so ridiculous, genuine meaning?
I think we struggle with that because there is a whole movement within sports writing to give it too much meaning. I will read things a lot where you're like, you're just talking about a spring training baseball game, man. Like, easy with the maudlin descriptions of the meaning of this. So I think it has its meaning, but it can only be commented on occasionally. Right? Does that jive?
Yeah, makes sense.
I think most of the time people are going to engage in their own meaning with it, and that like the more spare you can be the better, because like in some ways when the Kansas City Royals made a World Series run 5 years ago, my brother and I were both living, he still lives here, but we lived in LA. We had a couple of friends who were from Kansas City. The Royals were not supposed to be good. The Royals hadn't even been to the playoffs since I was 7 years old, right? And there's something fun about being in LA, which is this very cosmopolitan and sometimes snooty place with sports fans who don't really understand sports because they have so many other things to do. It was really fun to watch the Royals in bars, and they just kept winning. And it was really hard to describe, like, why is this so much fun? I played professional sports. Like, I'm not in awe of baseball players, but there was something so primordial, I guess, about like my brother and I being together and watching these games that we used to watch when we were kids. And for whatever reason, baseball works really well with Midwesterners and father-son stuff. And so like that stuff is in there, but does it always need to be expressed in writing? I'm not sure. Like, I think it maybe once a year, yes, but otherwise probably it needs to stay flippant and then let people bring their own take to it. Does that sound like something you would?
Yeah, that does. I think your purpose is to be entertaining first, foremost, and maybe even almost exclusively. I think to write about sports with the real, it's nice to have a few stats in there and be a little bit analytical, but it should always be in the pursuit of being either silly, funny, or entertaining, or relatively thoughtful. I think it, too often it tries to be insightful, which I think is a mistake. I think you just want to be, just want to have a lot of fun with it, I think, anyway. I don't suppose you read Ben Gordon's essay or memoir where he spoke about mental health and the anxiety that basketball requires. You know, you got to think about all those little micro things that are going on in a game. He talked about needing to be in the mind, playing through all the possible slip-ups and obstacles to his goal. I don't know if you read that. Did you read that article by him?
I did, actually.
Did you relate to it? I thought it was a really unique perspective. What do you think of it?
I do think that there are so many overlooked causes and contributing factors to the way someone ends up playing a sport. So again, I don't know why I keep going back to baseball, but maybe that's because baseball is such a weird sport. There are all these pitchers who will just lose it at some point, right? They can't throw a strike. They can't throw as hard as they once could. There's a guy that pitches for the Kansas City Royals now named Matt Harvey, who was, you know, like Cy Young fella, pitched in the World Series for the Mets against the Royals, and now just doesn't have it anymore. He's not significantly older than he was. It just isn't there. And I think it's hard for people to maybe understand how many factors go into that, whether it's – I just this morning – was with a physical therapist. We were doing dry needling, the details of which do not need to be gone into here because it's pretty boring, but I'm still figuring out ways.
Sounds like a euphemism, just quietly. But.
Yeah, it does. I'm still trying to figure out ways to heal my body. I'm 42 and I'm still recovering from a career that ended, you know, 10 years ago. And it's hard for me to know during my career what of those nagging injuries were continuing to nag, and if I had just rested a little bit more, maybe I would have healed, and then that healing would have allowed my mind to stop obsessing about why I feel bad. And if my mind has time to stop obsessing, then maybe I can focus on just existing in the moment. It is a complicated endeavor when you mix like body with brain and hope for peak performance at all times, and I think we all maybe know that deep down, and that's why we admire the people who excel at it year after year. But sometimes it's hard to remember that when somebody's failing and to understand like, oh, there's probably other things at work here. It's not just his body. It's not just his ability to concentrate. He's got relationships to deal with. Maybe the nutrition that he was exposed to when he was 17 years old is finally catching up with him. Like we want simplicity, and it is rarely so simple.
And I think what I got from his article as well was so incredible. It's like, can you imagine if you did another job, whether it's a writer or something else, and there is someone who is purposely trying to stop you at every endeavor. You know, when you go on a basketball court, there's someone who is purposely trying to stop you and impede your progress and bump you and in some cases hurt you. And then at the same time, you're thinking about that obstacle, then you have to go and do that to someone else. It's right. A really, the narcissism involved here and the sort of hunted to hunted, prey to to Predator. Chris Anstey spoke about the night with the Russian hookers, getting barred from going out, but then just walking straight by the coach. What made you friends with Chris Anstey? What was it about him as a person that you like? And as a player, what was he like as a player as well?
He was one of the few people I ever played with who I think thought exactly like I did, which was like, if you're open, shoot it. If not, pass it. And let's just try to win the game, which is like, should be the default option.
Yeah.
But I think he also understood how basketball worked at such a granular level, which again, I sort of assumed that when you're a fucking professional basketball player, you would just run into those guys all the time, but you don't. He could see the game and understand its global nature. And I don't mean like around the world, but just how everything was going to affect everything else, and could then therefore see what was going to come next, which I wonder if that had something to do with him playing tennis growing up. Like, I think there's a lot in tennis of like having to sort of think ahead a little
physics,
bit.
Like if I hit it.
Yeah. I mean, Steve Nash kind of worked that way. And I wondered also if like him thinking about soccer helped him to process basketball a little bit differently. Chris also just came along at a time when I think I was so much the idealist about like, this is how I think my career is going to go. And I think he was probably a little bit like that. And he's older than I am by a little bit. So he was now a little more jaded. And so it was refreshing to find somebody who was like optimistic. I think like, cynicism is born of optimism, right? Like you're hopeful and you get disappointed a bunch of times. And I think he was kind of like me in that he was like really hopeful that sports would go one way. And then it often didn't go that way. And then we happened to connect. We only played like I was only on that team in Russia for 2 months, and he had appendicitis, blown up appendix. And so we only got to play together, I don't know, 4 or 5 times or something insanely small. But even playing like 2-on-2 with him in practice, I was like, this is what professional basketball was supposed to be like all the time.
I don't suppose you've read any of his recent writing. He's been sort of commenting on the NBA and just sort of a bit of life as well. He puts it out through his Facebook group, and some of it's really insightful. Like he spoke about Steve Nash and why he likes Steve Nash and why the hiring was the way it was. He's doing really well. One thing I had here was you talk about the Russian hookers. And one of the hookers says to you, maybe we go back to your hotel, relax, little sex, what you call menage a trois. You say, I gave her a smile and a no, and then finally left, which actually surprised me. Aren't whores supposed to negotiate? And I thought, was there any thought to giving that the title of your book? Aren't whores supposed to go negotiate?
That's a pretty, I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Yeah. In mercenary prostitution land, one of the things that was frustrating about the NBA actually was they had all these fixed salary levels, right? So like you couldn't negotiate anything lower than certain levels. So like it kind of would hamstring you, because I would say to my agent, like, well, let's just get me a job playing for X team, right? And he's like, well, but they would have to pay you this much. And I'm like, well, I'd play for half that. Like, I don't care. Right. So it was, I remember vividly it was like Orlando, where he tried to work out some deal where we were like, look, Paul will give you the money back if he doesn't make the team. Like all you have, if you guarantee him this much and then he ended up not being on the team by X day and you're not pleased with him, he will pay you the money back. And it was just like impossible, which kind of sucks. Cause like you wish you could come up with like creative ways. Cause I would have been one of those guys who's like, all right, I'll play for $1,000. Like whatever. Yeah. Like let's just you make it entirely performance based. If we win, I get paid. If we lose, I don't. And that's fine.
That's awesome. I think that would be a better world in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. We have imports in our league, Americans that come over. Fans and analysts, they can, you know, they get down on them. Import does poorly, it's cut him loose, get someone else. I was about to say, do you have a way of knowing at a glance that a player is going to be good or bad? But also, what would you say to fans where it's like, what are the sort of rules about an import where it's like, you know, maybe give them 5 weeks, then you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, are there any cues that you kind of go by to tell whether imports are, you know, not only good players, but good people?
I would say that it's a lot like managing a company or a team within your company, in that if you hire people you believe in, then you have to trust those people to make the right call. So by that, I actually mean, if you believe in the general manager of your team or whoever is making these personnel decisions, then you just have to trust like that they have made these decisions for a good reason. And if it's anybody's fault, it's probably that manager,
right?
Not the player. Cause like the player is just doing their, I've met very few players in the world ever who've ever been like, you know what, I'm just going to go be bad. Like that doesn't, it rarely crosses their minds. So it's sort of more of a top down thinking, I would say, of like, is it really the employee's fault if they do something wrong, or is it more the manager's fault because they didn't communicate to the employee what they were supposed to do?
Right. Yeah, fair enough. That interview with Bill Simmons, I remember it actually came up and I sent it to you, and because I sort of thought I'd look to it for a bit of research or whatever. And you obviously hadn't heard that in a long while. It seemed like you two had a similar voice, you and Bill Simmons. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a thought to you working there? With what was his Grantland, what he is now Ringer, was that ever discussed? Is it an option now?
We do have, I think, a pretty similar sensibility.
On sports anyway, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And oddly enough, when I pitched the TV show, we had the same literary agent, and they connected us to start that pilot together. And so we spent 3 days working on a pilot before any of this other stuff happened that we sort of started talking about at the beginning of the show. And so I was really pumped. I remember vividly that we were going to call the team the San Diego Zoo, which is fucking great. And we had come up with the whole storyline and like how the pilot was going to work. And he just knew sports so well, and he's super creative. And I had a ball, you know, just the two of us spitball and stuff. And then on the third day, he's like, all right, well, thanks for these ideas. I'm going to go write this pilot now. And I was like, wait, what? We're writing this together. Like, no. I have all this experience writing, so I'm going to write the pilot and you'll just be like a consultant. I was like, the fuck? No, that's not the deal. Yeah. So we actually had to mothball the whole thing and get ourselves out of that, like, vague agreement. There was no real contract, and that's what led to then me getting packaged with this guy Dan Fogelman and some other people. So we were in fact together for a little while, but I think his ego got the best of him.
Really, it's such a shame, because I've often thought, I thought there may have been a situation like that, because I thought, Paul, you're writing when you were with those other internet sort of things. I was like, this is what they do, you know, and you'd be really good for it.
I think it had a chance. It's just that I don't know, maybe he just didn't think I was going to be a writer ever, and I was just going to be like a fount of information, and perhaps it got miscommunicated to him. I don't know.
And was it quite explosive at the end there?
No. I mean, it was, he was super kind to me, even in, you know, turning people on to the blog, and he wrote nice things about my writing. So it was more just a surprise to me. I was just like, oh, okay, I guess this isn't going to work.
That's too bad. I've got here a quote. Every person in history, regardless of remarks to the contrary, has an easier time rooting for someone who looks like him. Enter me. I'm the liaison between the fan and the sport that left him behind when Larry Bird's back began to ache. Great line. Just first of all, that really sums up. I mean, when you talk about sports, race, and your place within it, that line kind of sums up the whole book. I've just got here a great line. Do you remember writing it? And let's talk about when you wrote it, if you can recall. Like, do you remember workshopping that line and getting the sort of cadence right? And I think you put 3 dot points in there to kind of extend it. Do you remember doing that line?
I remember having that thought. I don't know that I remember that exact moment, but I think it probably was crystallized when I was in foreign countries, where it was frustrating sometimes to know that there were only two Americans allowed, and then you got there and you're like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, these Spanish guys don't want to see a bunch of Americans come over here. Like, that's crazy. And I think it is fascinating to me that we struggle to talk about how that would be true here in the US. I think, like, in Russia, when Chris and I were there, there was a rule where there had to be two Russian players on the court at all times, not just on the team, right? Like, they had to be physically on the court, which made for some weird sort of substitution and stuff. And again, if you're a player and you get there and you look into the stands, you're like, oh yeah, it's a bunch of Russians. They probably want Russians to succeed. It doesn't seem particularly confusing, but I think it is, if you were to say those things here in the US, you know, about baseball, for example, where there are a ton of Central Americans playing, if you raise an issue with that, I think you would get run out on a rail. But it's pretty much the same as what we faced when we were playing overseas. And again, that seemed fairly logical to me. As someone who was also, I was effectively being discriminated against, and I was like, yeah, I would discriminate against me too.
Because I've often looked at our import two import rule and thought, why do we, this is, you know, when the program was small, it was to sort of push through Olympic players and preserve the Australian game. I don't know if we need it so much anymore, but hearing your response, maybe I'll change my mind about that. My last question for you. The last line of your book reads, most importantly, I'll ride off into the sunset, sunrise, because you know, you wouldn't ride into a sunset because then it's dark and you're in trouble, but you ride into the sunrise happy, because at least the Suns, unlike the Lakers so long ago, let me keep my jersey, reiteration of the title, good stuff. I'll ask you this question. You talked about how the book is basically your descent from into being jaded. Are you the hero or the villain of your book?
I think I'm the observer, and what I've probably done is maybe I've taken my hopes for basketball, that is the hero, and basketball itself is kind of the antagonist. And it's a job of like those hopes being mostly beaten up, but yet I am trying to maybe express there at the end that the hero still lives, right? His hopes still are alive. They're just battered and beaten around a little bit.
So yes, the hero.
Well, the hopes are the hero. I'm the observer. Yeah. Observer. You know what I'm saying?
Who's the villain?
Basketball is the villain, right? Like the machine of basketball is probably the villain or the antagonist in this case.
The game itself, like is there something inherent about the game because the ball can only rest with one person? Does it breed selfishness or is it everything around the game?
I think it's just that you go in, like it's the naivete that I had as a kid is kind of the heroic version of me, and then basketball and anything that gets corporatized is going to be a little bit villainous. And so it was, you know, I think I was defeated by that many times along the way, but ultimately I think I kept hold of some hope.
Yeah, I agree. And when you say you're an observer, I think you're a fair one, you know, both positive at times, negative at times. I really enjoyed the book. I've had this book, read it a couple of times, and read it most recently in preparation for this, and it holds up. Can you still buy it?
Thank you. Yeah, I think you can find it on Amazon. That's very kind of you to say. I of course am mostly frustrated with my own current writing in the same way that I was probably frustrated with that book when I was writing it, and so it is hard sometimes to take stock of like, oh yeah, I did that. That's cool.
No, I think all young men should read it. I think whether they're into basketball or not, I think it's got opinions and stories in here that would help a lot of people out. You're working on Writer's Block podcast. I listen every week, so there's some positive affirmation. I really enjoy it, and the guests are great. I think you get a lot out of them.
Thank you.
Have you got a philosophy with asking questions?
I'm trying to get better. I think you do a fine job of it. I think it's... So this is the first time I've had a podcast where it's just me and a guest. Before this, I did a podcast with my friend Justin Halpern about the NBA. And that was more just us bantering and then talking to a guest. So I'm learning all the time to just get the hell out of the way. I think in my history on podcasts, it was more about me, not me specifically, but just the two of us talking. And now it needs to be more about the guest and their wisdom. So it's really been the job of keeping my mouth shut when that is necessary, while also just maintaining a conversation, right? I think that's what people really love on a podcast, is the sense that, like, oh, these are just two people who are exploring things anew each time.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when I'm doing this, I do it by myself. So I'm having this conversation directly with a listener. That's interesting. And then you have interviews, which are different. So do you like the podcast form? Because stories I tell on dates, like when that was going on, it kind of disappeared for a while.
I think what happened was the company that did it maybe took it. It just went down with all of their stuff. And then we had to put it back up recently without commercials. Stories I Tell on Dates is amazing because of the production that went into it. So it's actually the same guy who produces the Writer's Block podcast, although it's much less invasive, but they were really ahead of their time when it came to, like, adding subtle
Foley atmosphere. Yeah. It's really good listen.
And had characters and stuff. And anyway, it was really, really cool. I was actually telling somebody this morning, like, it's kind of bizarre. I've been doing podcasts now for like 11 years, I think.
Wow.
My brother and I, people would maybe know my brother's work because he makes humorous charts.
He's got Dave, he's on Instagram. He's got a very, really quippy.
Matt Shirley it's Surelee, I think. He has like 350,000 followers. He's real funny. And we had a podcast 11 years ago that was just like, somebody said, hey man, you write for ESPN and you seem okay. Would you want to do one of these podcast things? And I was like, all right, sure. I think it's such a good test too of, it's a good test of being succinct and saying what you want to say and then getting out.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I'm a big Hemingway guy. You like, who you were talking about in the last Writer's Block podcast, John Irvine, never read his stuff.
Oh, John Irving. Yeah.
Irving, pardon me. What do you like about him and his style?
He is so good at creating a world and passing time. So I'm terrible at writing when it needs to express a vast amount of time. I can do a pretty good job of, like, all right, I got to get down to the store and buy the food and here's the deadline. I got to have it done by this. And I can tell you that story. But if it's like, tell you the whole life, it's bad. He's really good at, like, talking about generations. Like, you know, this person, we get a close up on their life and then we zoom way out and time passes and we zoom back in. Same as, like, Tom Wolfe's really good at that. Richard Ford is really good at that. And I'm bad at it. So I'm just in awe of it.
What do you think the future of writing is? The internet's come along. Sports is in a hell of a, hell in a handbasket in sports. So, you know, like, books, like, are people going to pick these up and still read them, or, you know?
They seem to be pretty, to be doing okay.
Airports and air travel are a huge leg up.
There's a cool special report on the technology that is the book probably 5 years ago in The Economist. And they wrote about, like, how it's weirdly portable and disposable and also substantive, right?
Tangible, so, like, right.
Yeah, there's something about it that just we keep coming back to. And I think people are actually realize, like, I don't read anything on the internet anymore. I mean, I'll see, like, tweets and stuff, but I don't, it's really hard for me to sit down and, like, read long form like I used to be able to do, because I think I have changed it so that my brain says, if it's the internet, it's, you know, I'm just here to do a thing and be done with it. Whereas, like, I think I read more now than I did 5 years ago. And I think a lot of people are that way. At least I'm hopeful that they are, because I think we're all learning to manage our time a little bit better and understand like what is a good use of our time.
I want to talk about that, like, money from the book. Do you see, like, you kind of look in your account and go, oh shit, a bit of money from Can I Keep My Jersey? Or was it all money in the beginning to write it? Or how does the money work with the book?
So they gave me an advance of $85,000 to write that
book. 85. That's good money. You were shocked at that amount?
Or? Yeah. Well, I had a literary agent and he negotiated it. When Random House got in touch with me, I do vividly remember typing into Google, how much is a book deal? Because I had no idea. I was like, is it $1,000? Does this mean I'm a millionaire? Like, what does it mean? And I don't remember. I mean, it just was like, well, yeah, it's negotiable depending on who the person is. So they gave me, it works that the $85,000 comes over the course of, this is basically 2 years. They gave you a third of it when you signed, a third of it when you deliver the manuscript, and a third of it when the book is published. 20% of that goes to your agent, right? So now you're down to whatever that is, 68 or something like that. And so then they start counting royalties against that toward you making back your advance, right? So like hardcovers counted at like, I don't remember exactly, $1.75 back towards that advance, and paperbacks are basically like a dollar, right? So my book has now sold, that book has sold, I think 40,000 copies, and I'm like 1,000 copies away from making back my advance, at which point I would then, as you said, get like a dollar each time somebody bought.
Oh, right. Book.
But realistically, probably only like two people will buy it each week. So maybe I would get like $6 or $7 a month.
Wow. Yeah, because it's an economy that's so strange to me. You know, I never know how it.
Yeah, and it's like I don't with stories I tell on dates. Speaking of inside baseball, for that I started my own publishing company, which doesn't. What does that mean, really? Right, it means I hired a designer and an editor and a copy editor.
Made a website.
Created a name for the publishing house, and so for that one, it's a little nicer because I'll get $5 a book. I didn't get an advance, right? But like each time somebody buys one, I get $5 or $3. I can't remember. It's just that it's a lot harder to actually get it into the collective unconscious because I don't have the muscle of the Random House behind it.
Yeah, you don't have the machine behind it.
But I've come to this point where I'm like, nobody's going to give me $250,000 to write a book at some point. So I might as well just write the books I love, put them out, and just not try to make money that way because it seems a bit foolish.
Yeah, well, yeah, I remember you saying that on another interview where you're just like, I don't think it's feasible that a podcast is going to take you enough, but you can still put out there. Yeah, no, I'm working on a few writing things myself. You said you're working on a fiction. What do you mind telling us the sort of plot of it or whatever?
Or it the vague is, ideas? Yeah, so it's. I'll send you one, and when it's done, and we'll come back on the podcast. It's called Ball Boy, and it's about a kid whose single mother moves him from Los Angeles to small town Kansas, where he finds basketball.
He's doing it in reverse.
A way to fit in and a way to then save the dying town from itself. So it's kind of like, I actually put him in Reseda, California, because that's where the Karate Kid takes place.
I've been watching Cobra Kai, you bet.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I've been watching Cobra Kai too. So I it's basically like a reverse of Karate Kid, only with basketball, if I'm honest.
Good one. I think, Cobra Kai, did you like the writing in that? I thought the way they picked little shreds, took little acorns of doubt from the movies, and then made the turned a hero, a villain into a hero. I think that's some of the best TV writing of the last little bit. It's funny and it's aware of itself, but never pushes it too far in any direction. I don't know who wrote that, but gee, just saying, writer's block podcast. Yeah, that'd be a nice guess. Yeah. Just saying.
Yeah, yeah, I'm into it.
Well, I'll let you go. I've been very generous with the time. I really appreciate it. But yeah, loving writer's block. I do a bit of writing myself, not just sports, which I'm hoping to transition away from into stuff that's more compelling. Is writer's block something where you're like, oh, this is quite a little business that could work quite well for you? Yeah, not to be too sort of.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is, I wasn't really joking about being the Peloton of productivity. Like, we want to extend it beyond writers to anybody who needs to just get work done. A lot of the times that's creative stuff. My mom uses writer's block so that she can just do her job. Cause I think there's a lot of value in teaching people about creating habits and routine. I'm also working on a book called The Process is the Product, which is about falling in love with the process, whether it's basketball or writing or business. And so I'm soon going to do some small groups on Zoom where I'll have people like do a little questionnaire about like, what are your habits like? What would you like to change this week? You know, those kinds of things. Cause I think that's something I can contribute, cause it's something I think about a lot, just like, you know, building a process and a routine.
And what is your process and routine? Are you a coffee shop guy, or are you quite particular? Are you noise? Are you music?
Do you work at home or do you go somewhere?
Well, no, I go to the office and work. So I work at a really, actually really lovely office, and I take some advice that I heard on SNL. I think it was Lovitz or one of the insert SNL cast member here. And they said to someone who was new to the show, asked him, you know, what, you know, I'm coming on SNL, what made you popular? And he said, listen, you have a office at 100 Rockefeller Center in New York City. What would the rent be on an office like that? You know, use your office. And so I sort of think, well, and I could do my work and leave. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, I've got rent on this building for free. I'm going to use it. So I do a bit of writing when I'm there. And I think, well, use that as my office. Because if I come home, when I come here, I do some work, but gee, it's pretty unproductive. So I'm desperately trying to find ways. Before, I used to go to the lending library, but with COVID, you can't do that anymore. I used to love just going, plugging in and sitting at a table, and the slight ambient noise, but the hushed noise I felt really helped me. But so finding something to replace that during COVID has been really, really difficult.
Yeah. I've been lucky that I have the physical space of Writer's Block to go to, even when we've not been open. But yeah, normally I'm at coffee shops all the time because I like that. What's like you're appeal? Saying. Well, there's something to me about the fact that there's some movement and noise somehow keeps me more concentrated. And it could also be that like in LA, there's such a culture of people working at coffee shops that there's just a lot of other people doing that.
You're not worried about being a cliche?
I mean, I don't love it, but it's better than like, I can't get very much done at home. So like, it's just easier for me to like actually get stuff done.
And what stops you getting stuff done at home?
Same thing as everybody. I think it's, it feels pointless kind of like there's, I just don't like being by myself, honestly. I mean, I like being by myself if it's like to read, but I like being around other people, and I get that energy of like other people. And I think if I'm out in the world, I feel then guilty if I'm on Facebook or something, whereas if I'm at home, it just always feels like I'm at this fine line of like I'll just descend into some rabbit hole on the internet and like not get work done. That doesn't really ever happen, but it seems like I have to use a lot of willpower to make sure it doesn't happen, whereas if I'm in a coffee shop, I don't have to use any willpower because I'm like, I'm not going to just sit here and look at Facebook with all these people walking past.
So the social dilemma would have spoken to you as it did to me. It spoke to you quite profoundly.
Yeah. Yeah.
The agitation it does. Yeah. The mindful agitation of it's here and it will purposely disturb you.
I think, you know, one of the things that came out of that was like, we've been wrestling because we actually raised some money for Project, which is this larger company in the spring. And I'm going to go out and raise some money again this fall. And one thing people are always telling you is like, well, you got to keep users engaged and blah, 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 blah. And I think that helped for me to define, like, that's not what I want. I want us to be a tool that people can use. Yeah, totally. And that's all. And that I think there's going to be a backlash against this stuff that just keeps you addicted. And that I think we could actually get ahead of that curve and say like, look, we're not trying to dominate your time. We want you to log on and work for an hour and then be done and go on about your day. Use us for what you need, but not anything more. You can engage with it if it helps you to like hear about, you know, productivity or ways people are getting stuff done, but like to just try to keep it as functional as possible.
Going back to stories of telling dates, did you write, like when you're writing for a podcast, did you use any tools? How did you know how to do that? Because that was really, I'm assuming it was different from when you wrote Can I Keep My Jersey, the style of it.
Well, I mean, no, it was, it, so the podcast is just the book.
Read out.
There's a book, Stories I Tell on Dates.
Yeah. And I remember I got in touch, I was like, where can I buy it? And you said, oh, it's just in the podcast.
Yeah. So it was, I honestly didn't write it with a podcast in mind, but I did write it in with it, the idea in mind of like, this is how I would tell the story if I were given 40 minutes to tell this story. Now, would I ever do that? Probably not. But like, I think it worked as a podcast because the chapters were very, really segmented in a way that made them consumable individually.
Yeah. Anyway, Paul, I'll let you go because you've been very kind. But
well, thanks for having me, man. It was fun to get to dive into some of this stuff.
Yeah, no. And when you look back on Can I Keep My Jersey, you're proud, I take it?
I mean, it's funny. Like, pick it up and I read portions of it, I'd be like, ooh, I could have written that better. But I have come to terms with that in that it was what I could do at the time.
Yeah, and, it was all its time.
You know, it's not like... I think you look at it objectively as me, and I think, you know, there's some things here I could have improved, but again, it's just, that's well, the best I could do back then.
Do you think they got return on their investment of 65K?
Yeah, actually, I think like for a publisher, they're taking home, especially on a hardcover, they're probably making like $8 a pop or something.
And you said it sold how many again?
Sold 40,000 copies.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, it's not you know, world beating, but it means that somewhat like Las Vegas, they knew exactly what the market was.
Pricks. Well, I've got my copy. I've got all notes through it. I could read it again, or should I give it to someone else? What would you prefer?
I prefer that you keep it and make them buy one.
Yeah. Okay. I thought that would be it. That is a great answer. Oh, real pleasure.
Thank you.
Hope to speak again in the future, but good luck with your book and your writing. And I hope you get some done today. It's whatever time over there.
Oh, I already did my writing for today. Don't worry. Make sure you get a session in and let me know how it goes. Send me a note.